Hello and welcome to Minted Dialogue, episode number 142. This interview is with Mark Thompson, a world-renowned executive coach who works with top business figures and legends such as Richard Branson and Charles Schwab, and previously with Steve Jobs. He's a best-selling author of three business books, including Success Built to Last. And in this chat, we get an inside view on the way that Charles Schwab took the digital revolution in stride. We also discuss the challenge for leaders today, an inspiring discussion. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Minted Dialogue podcast, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Minted Dial, your host and author of The Mindset. That's MYNDSET.com, where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes to the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick and enjoy the show.
So, Mark Thompson, you and I have known each other over the years. Great to have you on the show.
So Thank you so much.
Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're up to, and what is your mindset?
Well, you know, I think I've had such a wonderful adventure having an opportunity to meet you, and I think, didn't we meet once first, I think, at TED or at the World Economic Forum or Southwest, and that says something about our learning mindset. I think we're both so hungry to be able to learn and share and, frankly, pay it forward because we both had successful corporate careers, and I think that at this point in our lives, we really feel like we can give back and have an impact and then learn more because we're always kind of greedy for information and greedy in only those ways and then try to find ways to serve others. So in my career, I've had the privilege of being able to work with three of the more exciting entrepreneurs who've created built-to-last organizations, Richard Branson, Charles Schwab, and Steve Jobs at Apple, and Charles Schwab not knowing perhaps all over the world, he's as best known as the other two entrepreneurs. But what he did is really democratize financial services for the individual investor at a time when only Wall Street provided high-end services and investment advice and low-cost financial services to institutions. He was able to bring that, kind of popularize a marketplace where everyone had equal access. That's something taken for granted in an internet world now. Yeah. But he did that in the 70s and 80s. We took it public in 87, just before the great crash of 1987.
Right.
So they always talk about the gray hairs coming early and building your character. Well, we took the stock from 16 to 6 in a single day, and it stayed there for 5 years. And every quarter we were challenged by not making our net regulatory capital requirements and losing money for years. And it really allowed us, I think, to understand how important it is to serve customers, build long-term relationships, and never, ever rest on your laurels and lose any sense of arrogance that usually comes quickly from success, but instead always reinventing yourself, always asking the question, how can we make you, the client, successful today? Mm. And today, Schwab has over $3 trillion in customer assets. Mm. When the crashes came in the most recent cycle, the market share of Schwab increased because they were partnering with the customer. They were never involved in the fancy, sizzling, sexy securities business that drove everything off the cliff. They were boring and solid and consistent and always the friend of the customer. So I'm kind of proud of how they did during all of that.
Well, you know, there's this great study about analysts, institutional investor analysts in Wall Street, because I worked on Wall Street, and I was actually working on Wall Street in 1987 at that crash, so I saw the tickers.
I remember standing on your desk and thinking about whether you'd run a jump out the window.
Absolutely. This is right in front of the World Trade Center, too. You've got these 5,000 II analysts that have been observed, and what they did is they looked at what would constitute or predict success for these institutional investors if they move from one bank to another, and the only statistically viable common factor was that they were a women, and the interesting. The interesting thing about that was, why were these women successful or predictably successful having moved from one bank to the other, was that they didn't have time to do the hot sizzle. What they did is they spent their time worrying about the client. So they would work 9 to 5, and then from 5 to 10, they have to go home, quote unquote, right? they'd go home and take care of their family, whereas the male institutional investors would be worrying about internal politics, career pathing, the next promotion, and also smoking cigars and going to have a whiskey with the boys after work. And so this whole, that part of the socializing was not so easy to do for the female analysts in this survey. And anyway, so the whole notion was that they were successful because when they moved to the other bank, well, the clients followed them. And they'd created this you know, trustworthy thing. So what I wanted to talk to you about, Mark, in this, when you brought it up about Schwab, was they've created a trustworthy brand, and then the internet experience came along. And can you talk through how they converted their offline business, because that was how it was created, into this online business, which is thriving?
Well, you know, it's almost advantaged. Well, they were never one of the biggest that started on Wall Street. They didn't have the advantage of huge revenues from institutional investors. They did not have the advantage of large number of physical stores. They did not have the advantage of long-term face-to-face physical relationship with a broker. Mm-hmm. All of those things were considered a disadvantage, and it was really quite prescient and brilliant for Chuck Schwab to come up with the idea that from the very beginning, he was going to be a telephone-based service, that he was going to not assign a specific broker to a client, mm-hmm. but that he was going to have the company as a whole, as a team, take responsibility and have incentives in place to care for customers and to shift what he always described as a conflict of interest that all brokers have, because they're paid on the amount of churn, on the velocity right. of transactions, right. rather than on the outcomes or performance of the transactions in general. That's how commissions work.
Right.
You get paid more the more you sell. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to change the game where there was not an individual broker who was being compensated that way, that the asset-based, fee-based advisory services were the most ethical. And so he actually helped assist a trend after one of the crashes, that last crash I just mentioned, mm-hmm. towards independent fee-based financial advisors. And many of these guys might have been brokers in the past, maybe not. They were men and women who had come with a sense that if I get paid, I get paid more only when the value of all the assets goes up. A revolutionary idea at the time. And today, still more than half of all of Schwab's business is based on being white labeling products and services and facilitating as a marketplace, as an engine, mm-hmm. as a software platform. From the very early days, before there was online, before there was an internet, mm-hmm. he was already providing this base, this mm-hmm. back office for fee-based financial advisory services that were very sticky, that were very much entirely relationship-based. In fact, that's where the fees were paid as a percentage of that. And then he created a marketplace for mutual funds in the United States. Those are the investment funds and unit trusts that allow people to be able to participate in large baskets of equities. And those were done on a fee basis as well. And he would try to sell the no loads or the lower loads so that he could provide a range of value options for the customer. And then finally, when the internet did come along, he decided to equalize pricing so that we could be agnostic as a company and realize that there isn't really an online customer and an offline customer per se, although at the time it would be easy to define them that way. Mm-hmm. That what you have is a customer. You have a relationship
Beautiful.
That's 24/7, mm-hmm. that's about taking care of you based on what your need is at the moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, you may not want to talk to anybody or see anybody. Just give me my cash out of the ATM. Just handle it for me. I got to cash a check and get the heck out of here. I don't want to have a conversation. And in the next moment, the customer is saying, no, I don't want to open that retirement account online. I want to see somebody. I want to talk to somebody. I don't understand. Or at least could you Skype with me and mm-hmm. take me through this discussion, because it's more complicated. There are many options. There are tax consequences. Mm-hmm. It's my family. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not an accountant or a lawyer. I need help here. So I think the epiphany that Chuck had early on was, how can you use technology to increase intimacy with the customer mm-hmm. as opposed to just increase efficiency? Mm-hmm. Because it can do both. What you used to have in your relationship with the fromagerie in the corner in Paris was that she or he knew exactly what you wanted and had it ready for you. and sweated it when they didn't have that particular product available. Oh my God, would you be satisfied with X because I don't have Y this week?
It sounds like Singapore Airlines.
Exactly. And so the relationship ends up being the automation that Chuck constantly bet the company's net worth on a level of automation that would increase the intimacy and change the incentives so that the habits and behaviors of the brokers were on the same side as the customer. I think those two things were game changers that led to, you know, $3 trillion in customer assets. And when I was producing Schwab.com, I was executive producer for many years, being a person who is very much interested in giving access to the celebrity investment advisors, access to celebrity CEOs, using this wonderful online platform. I did Steve Jobs' very first webinar. We did the very first webinar that Jeff Bezos did, the very first one that Jack Welch did. Mm. This was before the turn of the century. It was because we wanted to find a way that we could bring, you know, a million investors to the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, because not everybody can travel there. Not everybody gets a front row seat because they don't have millions to invest. Mm. So how could we, in a sense, crowdsource the fact that we had lots of little investors that add up to billions and give them services as if we had one chunk of $1 billion to invest in your company or in your investment plan. And so that's, you know, that's about three or four different ways that Chuck really had this vision for changing the game for the little investor. And I don't think people even realize. I was interested to see the other day, I was on a panel and one guy said, "Oh, I didn't realize that even Charles Schwab was a person, or that he still was alive." And I said, "Yeah, I guess I'm that old." He is very much still a driving and ethical and kind of spiritual force in that business. And I've always been attracted to people like that because I think they got their original mojo from the fact that they struggled in their youth. He's dyslexic. Mm-hmm. He knew that he was never going to be the smartest guy in the room in every capacity. So he ends up scaling a business faster out of Stanford Business School than probably any other guy did that graduate year, because he never for a moment assumed that it was all about him. He had to recruit people like you and me and others who had a vision as large as his that he could empower and engage and trust. And that's what Richard Branson does. And I think that started with his learning disabilities the same way. You know,
a common theme, right, with Jobs is not graduating from university. Mark, I know you have to leave. So I wanted to ask you one more question, which, you know, listening to you about Charles Schwab, Branson and Jobs, these are the kind of people one will talk about an inspiring leadership entrepreneur. They own the brand. They are the brand. The question I wanted to ask you was, if you're dealing with a mercenary, I want to call it mercenary, at least a non-founder CEO, guy who's been parachuted in, or his, you know, maybe he's 30 years in the company, but that person, he or she, doesn't have the founder blood in him or her, might have PE backing, and anyway has shareholder pressure, and somehow just doesn't incarnate the brand and take the same risks that you will constantly see in a founder CEO. So working with that kind of a CEO, how do you dimension or approach bringing that fire and that entrepreneurial zest and learning that you incarnate yourself to them?
Well, the most important thing is that people who are hired as professional managers, as you describe, they're really coming in to make the mission work. We have to connect the dots as coaches between the mission that they have or the outcomes that the private equity or the board of directors is looking for in terms of financial returns, and tie that into the fact that the only thing that will differentiate your brand, product, or service right now will be the quality of the customer experience. That the customer experience, coming from the world that you do, you probably have started out your career with a greater level of depth of understanding of that, because it's such an emotional experience. But having that connection and realizing that there is a return on the ROI here is return on intimacy. Mm-hmm. It's an ability to connect for that professional manager, the fact that the only way to get from here to there, the only way to see the transformation, is to galvanize the customer experience that makes the customer stay and not click away, that makes the customer not accept $200 from the other guy, and keeps the business here. It gives a reason for customers to come back, and in a sense makes the people who provide customer service behave like owners, because you're talking about these owner-operators.
Right.
But the ownership sense comes from being empowered to make decisions. So in the field, when the airline is letting you down, what is it that the people in the field can actually do for you rather than just to make excuses? Do we give them the tools to keep that customer? Mm. Do we give them the tools to make them so excited that they're, like I was that day with Singapore Airlines and Etihad, just tweeting it to everyone about how great they did rather than what a disaster and how dysfunctional that airline is. Everybody who's a customer now has a bully pulpit, don't they? They have a platform. And so I think what the professional manager has to realize is we are all naked. We no longer have control. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is inspire our customers to want to be raving fans. And the only way to do that is to make our employees' teams feel like they own the customer experience. Mm-hmm. And so if we can create a platform that allows your call center or the front line receptionist at the bank or the anyone who answers the phone.
Anyone in touch with the customer.
You're right there at Zappos, right there in Las Vegas where you are right now. I remember taking that visit with Tony Hsieh and saying, you know, this last person on the line – she was on the phone for 5 hours with the customer, but that customer bought $1,000 worth of shoes and probably sold $10,000 because she's an influencer and tells everybody the best place to get the Tom Ford shoes. Yeah. And so understanding that if we give the employees more power to create a greater customer experience, that is return on investment is not always an easy thing to sell. But I think there's enough disruption in the marketplace with the Ubers and the Airbnbs and with the Zappos of the world that, a retailer who might be traditional might have to look at the fact that the online customer experience is not just something to be tolerated, but something to be celebrated.
Mark, beautiful. I know I could be speaking with you for hours.
Literally. Well, we need to have that cup of coffee. Let's definitely connect on this side of the pond or the other. I think, I know that I'm going to be spending a lot of time there at the end of June and into the summer, and then I'll be in New York. And you're coming back to San Francisco soon, so let's definitely get together.
So, Mark, there's a million things that people can read of yours, which I'll put in the show notes. What's the best way to connect with? How would you prefer people to follow you and find out what you're up to?
Well, I think it's easy to find me at my full name, www.markcthompson.com, markcthompson.com. There you can find the books that we've written, the blogs, the LinkedIn profiles, all the ways that we are streaming out to and paying forward to the world. And we'd love to hear from you. We've got free research at markcthompson.com. So if you'd like to hear more about what goes on behind or the research upon which we based some of the comments we made today, this is all available there.
Fantastic day.
You too. Thanks for checking in with me. Take care.
Bye. Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com. That's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes. That really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray and heal me with all your imperfections that you mention in your lack of self-security. Slowly we would paint alone. so messy. The ridges in our palms make colors blend and look ugly in the end. But they're pretty in their own disgusting values. We'd hang our portraits in the hallways, make our house guests cringe. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm seeing all your colors on the canvas as we paint a lover's portrait with all your favorite shades. And we'd paint it with our fingers to show with all your favorite shades, and we paint it with our fingers to show the world the way we feel. Oh, oh, the way I feel.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We out.